Hi, friends. How are we doing? Well, thank you for coming to church today, and I want to welcome those of you who are joining us online. We're thrilled you're a part of what God's doing here at Capitol today as well. We continue a series called The Life and Lyrics of David. We're following David as God calls a young shepherd from Bethlehem to become the shepherd of a nation. Along the way, we're considering some of David's prayers as we study some of David's psalms. Before we open our Bible, let's open our hearts and open our minds so we can hear from God. Will you join your heart with me? Lord, I know we're all at different places on the spiritual journey. Some of us are just beginning to trust you. Some of us have been trusting you for decades. And some are just trying to see if you're real. For all of us on this journey together, may we leave or log off today with a greater faith in your faithfulness. We pray this in the name of King Jesus. Amen. In this series, as I said, we're getting a glimpse into David's spiritual life by studying the prayers that he prayed in the Psalms. So I thought I'd give you a peek into my life by reading some excerpts from a prayer journal. Now, I've only done this on one other occasion over the last 20 years, but as we were putting together this message this week, we thought this exercise might be profitable for us as a community. Let me explain at the outset. My prayer journals are really a combination of three or four classic spiritual practices. I don't make entries into my prayer journal every day. In fact, the frequency of my entries ebb and flow depending upon the season. But I've recorded most of my prayer journal prayers on Saturdays. And that's because Saturdays are my writing days. Most Saturdays find me sitting in front of a laptop writing the words to these messages. I keep the journal on my computer, on a Word document, and I return to it throughout the day. Usually, I set my iPhone to interrupt me every hour while I'm writing. See, when my alarm goes off, I stop what I'm writing, and I make an entry into my journal. I find it keeps me connected to God throughout the day. Now, those of you who know a little about concentration and attention may deem this to be a glorious way to lose focus. If writing my message is the main thing I'm doing, I shouldn't allow myself to be so frequently interrupted. You're right. But that's just it. Writing my message isn't the main thing I want to do. Staying connected to God is the main thing I want to do. So I often use my prayer journal on writing days. Now, as I share my prayer journal with you today, I realize some of you in the room aren't even convinced there's a God. And as you read what I wrote to God, you may wonder if I'm a bit loopy. Well, let me say up front, I am. But that doesn't mean God doesn't relate to people personally. Throughout the Bible, and not to mention human history, we find accounts of individuals engaging God one-on-one. Perhaps you've heard a follower of Jesus talk about having a personal relationship with God. Well, for what it's worth, I experience God personally every day. No, not through angels or earthquakes, but usually in the gentle nudges of his spirit in my conscience, my heart and mind. And over time, I've learned to discern when it seems to be God speaking, not just me. Now, I want to take you back to an old prayer journal entry a little over 9 years ago. That morning, I got up pretty early in the day. When I opened my prayer journal, the heading at the top of the page lists the day. It happened to be February 28th, and the year was 2015. The time was 4:30 a.m. Only God and I were awake at that hour, but I was up at that hour. And that morning, I began the journal entry like I begin almost every journal entry, and it's with the words, good morning, Lord. Now, I want you to note, my prayer journals are prayers. They don't begin, dear diary. I'm not talking to myself. And there's a reason I type these prayers. Do you ever have grand ambitions to sit and pray? But you find when you do, you lose focus about 60 seconds in? Well, even without knowing it, my mind can wander off to my to-do list or the next Zoom meeting, right? Well, over the years, I found that typing my prayers focuses my thoughts. And when I write in my prayer journal, I take the advice of C.S. Lewis. I pray what's in me, not what ought to be in me. So often in my opening paragraph, I take my thoughts and my feelings, whatever they are, and just go splat onto the page. Now, I did that on February 28, and it was a very interesting paragraph. I looked back at it this week. I'm not going to show you that paragraph. Not because of the profanity, but because it's not my story to tell. You see, as I pray, what's in me, my difficult conversations and difficult decisions make their way into my journal. And so I'm not going to share those details, but I can share what happened that week. It wasn't good. It was a terrible week. Several things snapped loose. And honestly, I walked into the weekend a little shaken up. Now, because of the drama, I didn't devote nearly enough time to my sermon during the week. That meant, as I come into Saturday, I had to compress an inordinate amount of thinking and writing into a short amount of time. That is the context of February 28. Okay? Usually when I write in my prayer journal, I structure my time by working verse by verse through a passage of Scripture as I talk to God. And that Saturday, I worked through Psalm 57. You see, the heading of Psalm 57 reads, here on the right of the screen, of David, a mikdam, when he had fled from Saul into the cave. Now, we've joined David a lot in the cave in this series, haven't we? This is one of those psalms written when David was running for his life from Saul. Now, in my journals, I simply talk to God about what I see in a passage and invite him to speak to me. That morning, I wrote this. The cave is dark. The cave is damp. The cave is cold. The cave is a place of fear. It's a place of deficit and dishonor. It's a place where the dweller wonders about your promise of provision. Then I move to verse 1 of the psalm. Have mercy on me, my God. Have mercy on me. For in you I take refuge. I write this. From the cave, David cries out for mercy. Chanan means to be gracious, to have mercy, to take pity, to be kind. It means to favor someone. Then at 5:30 a.m., I pray, I say this. I just lost my place. Here it is. The repetition of verse 1 gets my attention. Twice David prays for mercy. There's a sense of desperation in his plea. Now, do you see what I mean by the repetition and the desperation? Have mercy, have mercy. David's repetition indicates David's desperate. So then I turn to my own soul. Lord, I pray, there's a little desperation in my prayer today. You know how much I have to write today. 6 p.m. will be here soon. That was the time of our Saturday gathering at the time. 6 p.m. will be here soon, but you're here now. Have mercy on me. Treat me kindly and graciously. Help me carry my burdens today with joy and confidence. Note, all I'm doing is taking David's prayer and making it mine. I take the second part of the verse. At 5:30 a.m., have mercy on me, my God. Have mercy on me, for in you I take refuge. I will take refuge in the shadow of your wings until the disaster has passed. I write, twice he prays for mercy and twice he commits to trust. In you I take refuge. David says, I will take refuge in the shadow of your wings until the disaster has passed. Now, here's what I wrote, but remember, I'm talking to God. David isn't a passive observer as he prays. He's an active participant. David decides to tuck himself up under your wing until the disaster passes. I say, for me, these prayer journals are one way of me taking refuge in you. As I pause to pray, I tuck myself under your wing so that I'll be okay. Then at 5:30 a.m., I pray this. Lord, I trust you today with this sermon. With blank, and with blank. I put my trust in you. Give me today my daily bread. Give me whatever I need to do, whatever you want me to do. I love you. Now, of course, my original journal had content in those blanks, but they were personal prayers where my story overlapped someone else's, so I kept it blank for this slide. But I'll tell you this, what struck me as I wrote this message this week, looking back 9 years ago, I am right now praying uncannily similar prayers with that blank and that blank and that blank. Got my attention. 1 hour later, 6:30 a.m., verse 2, I cry out to God Most High, to God who fulfills his purposes to me. Here I write, David cries out to God Most High, Elohim Elyon. This is a title used of you when a writer wants to emphasize your supremacy and your power. In other contexts, Elyon refers to something that is very high. You see, as I work throughout the text with God, I'm almost preaching to myself. I pray, there is nothing and no one higher than you, and it is to you that I cry out now. Your power is unmatched. You can write this message in a moment, and you're the God who's hearing my prayers. Now, do you see how I keep bringing my sermon to God? I'm just praying what's in me, and what's in me is panic. Because I do not have enough time that day to write what needs to be written. And I know it. I'm way behind. Now, is God going to come through for me with my sermon? Of course he is. I write this. In this moment, I remind myself that you will work in me, through me, and around me to accomplish your purposes for me today. That means I can trust you with this sermon. I believe. Help my unbelief. Well, that passage is one where I'm just being honest with God. I never intended anyone to read this. It's probably good that you're reading it now. But I have unbelief too. At 7:30 a.m., I move to verse 3. He sends from heaven and saves me. Shalach in Hebrew means to send out or dispatch. I pray, what are you sending from heaven? Whatever it is, it saves me. The Hebrew word for save here doesn't simply pertain to salvation from guilt, sin, and punishment. That's certainly true too. It's a general word for deliverance. From what do I need deliverance today? Do you see how I ask God a question? Here perhaps I pause to listen. I read the rest of the verse, verse 3. He sends from heaven and saves me, rebuking those who hotly pursue me. God sends forth his love and his faithfulness. Apparently, I have an epiphany because I realize what he's sending from heaven to save me from is fear. Lord, I pray, I need deliverance from fear. That's my true enemy. Rebuke the fear that's chasing me. Pursue is sha'af, which means to pant after, to long for, to pursue. Fear hopes to overtake me and consume me, but you send from heaven. By the way, my greatest fear is fear of failure. I fear failure more than I fear death. Really. And that means I have a very healthy understanding of the afterlife. Or a very unhealthy view of this life. I hope it is the former, not the latter. But my greatest fear is fear of failure. I ask for deliverance from fear And how does God respond? What do you send? I ask. You send forth your unceasing love, that's the word chesed, and your faithfulness or reliability, that's the word emet. That's why I can trust you. Your unceasing love and your trustworthiness rebuke my fear. Rebuke is haraf, which means to defy, to ridicule, to taunt, to mock, to insult. And love, your love and faithfulness mock my fear. Anything I will ever face looks very small next to you, my refuge. I trust in you today. Then at 8:30 a.m., I offer an update on my sermon. It's 8:30 a.m. I'm in the middle of my intro. I say, I probably feel worse about the message than it actually is. I'll probably be okay. Stop right there. That word gets a double strike. You've got me, and I trust you. I won't put my trust in my talent or my time. Then I move on to verse 4. Just working through the psalm. I'm in the midst of lions. I'm forced to dwell among ravenous beasts, men whose teeth are spears and arrows, whose tongues are sharp swords. I write, I don't have enemies like David, but I have fear. Fear is my enemy. Fear of failure. Fear that this message won't do what you want it to do. David's imagery for his enemies is wonderful and scary. Sometimes my fears look like ravenous beasts. Then I write, you and I both know I'm in over my head. As a pastor, as a leader, as a communicator, but you're in control and I trust you in spite of the lions, in spite of the clock, tick tock, tick tock. Then at 9:24, I return to the journal a little early. And this is probably gonna sound strange. I was writing in a public place, I was in a coffee shop, and sometimes I feel prompted to pray for the people around me. And that's what happened today. I say to God, I caught a couple sitting near me, repeatedly staring at the Capital Church logo on my jacket. Lord, use even this little logo to lead people to you. Give that couple a curiosity about our community. I pray they check out our website. If they're hurting, may they sense this is a moment that you are showing them you're near. Help them seek you and find you. Next, I read verse 5. Be exalted, O God, above the heavens. Let your glory be over all the earth. I write this, Lord, this is a praise break for David. Be exalted, my God, even beyond the heavens. I say, you're higher than anything I could think or imagine, so I'll try to offer you praise to match. May your glory be over the earth, over the couple sitting next to me, over the people who come to church tonight and tomorrow, over the sermon I'm writing. May your glory be over all the earth. Be praised in this message this weekend. At 10:30 a.m., I moved to verse 6. They spread a net for my feet. I was bowed down in distress. They dug a pit in my path, but they've fallen into it themselves. I write, David's enemies try to trap him. According to 1 Peter 5, the devil is my enemy. The apostle writes, be sober-minded, be watchful. Your adversary, the devil, prowls around like a roaring lion, seeking someone to devour. I write, the devil sets a trap for me. He really wants to take me out. Whether he desires to use fear or anger or anxiety, he wants to distract me and ultimately disqualify me from doing your work. For me, the devil is that lion of verse 4. I say, David says he was bowed down in distress. Lord, I know what it's like to be bowed down in sin and stress. Satan intended to dig a pit in my path to make me fall. But it appears he has fallen in instead. I write, Lord, my lack of time to prepare for this message would have ordinarily raised my blood pressure and driven me to anxiety, but it has in fact driven me to you, my refuge. In our text from this sermon, you warn Peter that Satan asked to sift him like wheat. I was teaching in Luke 22 that weekend. Satan intended my crazy week to sift me like wheat. But he fell in the pit he dug for me. You have used my difficult week to draw me closer to you. I love you, Lord. Thank you for reminding me right in the middle of the sermon that I can trust you in every circumstance. Do you see how, as I worked through this over a period of hours, as I worked through this passage, my faith has grown. And even though I'm way behind on my message, I'm moving ahead and I'm connected to God, and it's absolutely wonderful and breathtaking. Now, while I'm making this entry in my prayer journal. I interrupt myself with these words. 10:57 a.m. As I was writing the prayer above, my hard drive crashed. I lost every sentence I have written thus far, even though, get this, I'd been backing up the sermon all morning long to a flash drive. Friends, that's exactly what happened. I lost every word of my sermon. Somehow that single file got corrupted, even though I was backing it up all day long. Interestingly, I didn't lose a single word to my prayer journal, but I lost every precious word of that sermon. I say to God, this doesn't make sense. The only thing that makes sense is Satan asked to sift me. Well, if that's true, then it means you allowed him to do so. I guess this is a new opportunity to trust your unceasing love and faithfulness. Lord, as you prayed for Peter in the garden, I pray for myself that you won't let my faith fail me. I know you won't fail me. Help me as I rewrite everything. 11 a.m. Okay, friends, the question I'm asking you today is this. What do you do when you don't know what to do? Well, what do you do when you're on the cusp of blowing it big? What do you do if you've already blown it big? But before we go any further, I want to introduce you to the principle we'll glean from David's story today, and perhaps a little of mine. It may not make sense to you right away, but I suspect it will by the end. Don't take your failure personally. Make your faith personal. When last we left David in 1 Samuel 25, he was still on the run from King Saul. David's story continues in chapter 26 as he's handed another opportunity to take Saul's life and thereby take the throne. Now, I won't take you to that story today, but I'll summarize it by noting David spares Saul's life again. However, David has learned by now, Saul will keep coming after him no matter what, no matter how he treats him. So in 1 Samuel 27, verse 1, we read, David thought to himself, one of these days, I will be destroyed by the hand of Saul. The best thing I can do is to escape to the land of the Philistines. Then Saul will give up searching for me anywhere in Israel, and I will slip out of his hand. The narrator gives us a rare glimpse here into the mind of David. Think about it, those of you who have been on this journey with us through 1 Samuel. Usually our storyteller just tells us what David does and what David says. Here we discover what David thinks. And that's important because it indicates that David is flummoxed and he's afraid of failing. Now, I don't know if David fears failing more than he fears dying, but in his circumstances, failure involves dying. So I suppose the question is moot. Here's David's dilemma. If he stays in Israel, Saul won't let him rest. He'll live on the run for the remainder of Saul's day. And David knows Saul wouldn't dare lead the armies of Israel into enemy territory just to find one man. But David is widely known as an enemy of the Philistines. Hiding in Philistia is a threat in itself. And living there indefinitely might require David to make a deal with his enemies that could compromise his commitment to the people of Israel. Look, the chances of failure are high either way. But maybe David's learning not to take failure so personally. We can confirm from his prayers in the Psalms that he certainly makes his faith personal. So, David and the 600 men with him left and went over to Achish, son of Maok, king of Gath. David and his men settled in Gath with Achish. He flees to Philistia. David probably intends to offer himself as a mercenary, a soldier of fortune for the Philistine king. But how could David make such a deal with a sworn enemy of God's people? Our narrator doesn't answer that question, but leaves the tension unresolved for now. Verse 3, each man had his family with him, and David had his two wives, Ahinoam of Jezreel, and Abigail of Carmel, the widow of Nabal. Okay, look, I think today's message should come affixed with a warning label, because the story we'll read will raise more questions than we have time to answer today. Questions like, what do you do with David's multiple marriages? Now, that's an important question, friends. The Bible's an ancient book written to an ancient people. So it's natural that reading the Bible from our contemporary outlook raises some hackles. But because the polygamy of the people of the Old Testament isn't the point of this passage, I'm not going to take time to talk about it today. In fact, David's story is going to kick up a lot of dust that we won't have time to clean up. Now, if you're new to reading the Bible, I empathically say to you, get used to it. That's what happens when you read an ancient document like this. But if you'd like a resource to help you think through and the interpretation of tricky passages like this, I highly recommend Scott McKnight's great book, The Blue Parakeet. Now, Dr. McKnight doesn't address polygamy directly in this book, but he'll give you some helpful ways to think about how God interacts with his people through history. For now, let's get back to David. Verse 5. Then David said to Achish, if I have found favor in your eyes, let a place be assigned to me in one of the country towns that I may live there. Why should your servant live in the royal city with you? David approaches the king, but he doesn't ask for a more valuable plot of land near the royal city. He intentionally asks for a town along the border near Israel. We don't know why just yet, but we'll find out shortly. So on that day, Achish gave him Ziklag, and it has belonged to the kings of Judah ever since. David lived in Philistine territory a year and 4 months. Basically, this means Achish gives David Ziklag, and David never gives it back. Verse 8. Now David and his men went up and raided the Geshurites, the Gerzites, and the Amalekites. From ancient times, these people have lived in the land extending to Shur and Egypt. As David and his 600 soldiers settle along the border, they combat many of Israel's historic enemies. Then we read this difficult sentence. Whenever David attacked an area, he did not leave a man or woman alive, but took sheep and cattle, donkeys and camels, and clothes. Then he returned to Achish. Okay, David's agenda seems to have been to seek out and wipe out the people groups that were meant to be removed when Israel settled in the Promised Land. David is again doing Saul's job as king. But how do we explain texts from the Old Testament in which God's people obliterate whole nations? Now, that's a really important question that we will not answer today. And I'm really sorry. But hear me, if you're bothered by these questions, and some of you are, at your place on the journey, maybe this is like a place where you've run into a roadblock on your journey with God. And if that's you, and your feelings are standing in between you and God, I'm going to encourage you to make your faith personal by doing a little digging on your own. And I want to give you my favorite book on this subject. It's Paul Copan's work, Is God a Moral Monster? Now, I don't recommend you keep it on your coffee table. We don't want to scare the children. But you can pick it up online. But by the way, Copan's answer to this question, the question in his title, is no, God is not a moral monster. But he empathizes with any thought or feeling we might have that says he is. As we return to David's story, we see David's purpose. David, at his borders in the north, tells Achish that he's been raiding Israel. But he hasn't been raiding Israel. He's actually just been raiding the enemies of Israel, and he doesn't want Achish to know. Well, apparently his ruse works. Achish trusted David and said to himself, "He has become so obnoxious to his people, the Israelites, that he will be my servant for life." Now, of course, Achish couldn't be more wrong. He's playing right into David's hand, and he has no idea. David's plan works brilliantly. Protected from Saul, fighting Israel's wars, until we come to the next chapter, chapter 28, verse 1. "In those days, the Philistines gathered for their forces to fight against Israel. Achish said to David, 'You must understand that you and your men will accompany me in the army.'" Uh-oh. Achish wants David to go with him into battle against the people of Israel. Now what's David going to do? His cunning has come back to bite him in the backside. And verse 2, David said, "Then you will see for yourself what your servant can do." Achish replied, "Very well, I will make you my bodyguard for life." David commits to joining Achish in battle. But his promise is a little more ambiguous than our English translation conveys. Basically, David says, "Now you'll get to see my true colors." What the heck is he going to do? Probably the whole time he's like, "What am I going to do? What am I going to do? What am I going to do? What am I going to do?" And again, we've got to ask, what do you do when you don't know what to do? What do you do when you get laid off? What do you do when the deal falls through at the last minute? What do you do when the test comes back positive? What do you do when you don't know what to do? What do you do when you failed gloriously or you're threatened by failure? You want to know what David does? Well, we don't know, because our narrator leaves us hanging. Like a modern-day filmmaker, our storyteller shifts scenes abruptly to bring us back to King Saul, chapter 28, verse 3. "Now Samuel was dead, and all Israel had mourned for him and buried him in his own town of Ramah. Saul had expelled the mediums and spiritists from the land." Now these editor's notes are seemingly out of place, but the placement of both facts makes more sense as we keep reading. You see, our narrator reminds us that Samuel, the prophet of God, has passed. And he informed us that Saul, as king of Israel, ran all the necromancers out of town, being faithful to the teaching of God. Verse 4, "The Philistines assembled and came and set up camp at Shunem, while Saul gathered all Israel and set up camp at Gilboa. When Saul saw the Philistine army, he was afraid. Terror filled his heart." Saul's petrified. He sees the size of their army and he fears failure and he doesn't know what to do. Verse 6 says, "He inquired of the Lord, but the Lord did not answer him by dreams or Urim or prophets." Now, we've explained what our narrator means by Urim on other occasions. For now, it's just important we understand these are means that God has sanctioned for someone to seek his counsel. Saul hoped to hear from God by proper channels, but God's not talking to Saul anymore. Of course, we know why God's not talking to Saul. It's because Saul stopped listening to God a long time ago. And Saul's not coming to God in repentance or remorse. Saul simply wants God to fix his problem so he can go back to being king without him. Now, how many of us simply want God to help us not fail, after which we plan to go right back to ignoring him, being the king or queen of our world without regard for him? And then if God chooses not to help us, how often do we get mad at him as if he's done something wrong? Saul inquired of the Lord, but the Lord did not answer him. Verse 7, "Saul then said to his attendants, 'Find me a woman who is a medium, so I may go and inquire of her.' 'There is one in Endor,' they said." Saul is so desperate, he seeks forbidden guidance. Now, we're unsure of the precise location of Endor. Some identify Endor with a lush forest moon, which was home to the hunter-gatherer Ewoks. But many archaeologists have identified Endor at a location which would have taken Saul behind enemy lines. get this, that Saul would even think about sneaking past the Philistines to consult a medium underscores his desperation. So Saul disguised himself, putting on other clothes. And at night, he and two men went to the woman. "Consult a spirit for me," he said, "and bring up for me the one I name." But the woman said to him, "Surely you know what Saul has done. He has cut off the mediums and spiritists from the land. Why have you set a trap for my life to bring about my death?" Saul swore to her by the Lord, "As surely as the Lord lives, you will not be punished for this." Then the woman asked, "Whom shall I bring up for you?" "Bring up Samuel," he said. Oh, this has stupid written all over it, doesn't it? The necromancer agrees to perform her duty. However, when the woman saw Samuel, she cried out at the top of her voice and said to Saul, "Why have you deceived me? You are Saul." Okay, this verse is like knocking down a wasp nest. All kinds of troubling questions come flying out at us. First, why is this woman startled to see Samuel? She just called up Samuel. Some commentators wonder if she ever had the power to summon spirits in the first place. Maybe she was a con artist, and this is the first time it really worked. We can't say for sure. Second, what made her recognize Saul? She sees Samuel, then recognizes Saul. What's going on? Third, and most troubling, was this really Samuel? I mean, come on. The fact of the matter is, this is one of the most troubling texts in the canon of Scripture. But Saul is one of the most troubling men in the canon of Scripture, so let's just go with it, okay? I told you, warning label. Saul asks for a description of Samuel. Apparently, she can see Samuel, but Saul can't. After describing the old prophet, Saul bows before the unseen spirit. Samuel said to Saul, "Why have you disturbed me by bringing me up?" This is not going to go well, is it? "I am in great distress," Saul said. "The Philistines are fighting against me, and God has departed from me. He no longer answers me, either by prophets or by dreams. So I've called on you to tell me what to do." Saul says he's in great distress. He uses the Hebrew word tsar. Literally, it means a tight space. Metaphorically, tsar signifies overwhelming stress and anxiety. It's an ancient expression that matches a few of our own. Being in a jam, being hemmed in on all sides, being caught between a rock and a hard place. And some of you know exactly what it feels like to be caught between a rock and a hard place. Conflict at work, conflict at home. You need a new roof, you lost an old client. Your kid's doing poorly in school. And you packed on 10 pounds eating kale and chewing on the envy you feel as you watch your skinny friend lose weight on a diet of his new Costco chocolate chip cookies. That's tsar. All happening at once. Saul would sure like to know how to face failure because he's about to fail badly and boldly. What do you do in such circumstances? Some of us get angry and defensive in the face of failure. Some of us reach for accusation and blame. Some of us lock up or frozen in place by terror. Still others, in desperation, reach for things we hope will give us peace or promise, clarity or comfort. But those things we think bring hope only bring more despair. And friends, it's not even logical. How many of us let stress drive us to drink? How many of us let pain lead us to addiction? How many of us have tried to alleviate our anxiety with sexual thrills? As if that'll take away the hurt. As if that'll take away the fear. In his desperation to get God's counsel, Saul violates God's command by seeking a medium. Samuel said, "Why do you consult me now that the Lord has departed from you and become your enemy?" The Lord has done what he predicted through me. The Lord has torn the kingdom out of your hands and given it to one of your neighbors, to David, because you did not obey the Lord or carry out his fierce wrath against the Amalekites. That was in chapter 15. The Lord has done this to you today. The Lord will deliver both Israel and you into the hands of the Philistines. And watch this. Tomorrow, you and your sons will be with me. The Lord will give the army of Israel into the hands of the Philistines. Immediately, Saul fell full length on the ground, filled with fear because of Samuel's words. His strength was gone, for he had eaten nothing all that day and all that night. Saul's calamity reminds us, going to the wrong place to alleviate fear only leads to more fear. Then our narrator takes us back to David. Poor David. Where's God in Philistia? But I don't know if you've noticed this. God wasn't even mentioned in chapter 27. Now, that was intentional on the part of our narrator. Think about it. There are many chapters in life when we may have trouble finding God on the page. But my dear friends, he's there. Behind the scenes, working through us, often in spite of us. In chapter 29, verse 1, the Philistines gathered all their forces at Aphek and Jezreel. And Israel camped by the spring in Jezreel. As the Philistine rulers marched with their units of hundreds and thousands, David and his men were marching in the rear with Achish. David falls in line with the Philistine warriors. But what in the world is he going to do as he's marching with his troops to the battle line? Look, the only thing worse than dying by the hand of King Saul is dying by the hand of King Saul as you betray your own people, the people you were called to lead. What in the world's he going to do? Better question, what in the world's God going to do? God delivered David from the lion. He delivered David from the bear. God delivered David from Goliath, from Saul, from Nabal, and from himself. But what's God going to do now? Verse 3, the commanders of the Philistines asked, what about these Hebrews? Okay, these commanders are the other rulers in Philistia, the peers of Achish. They ask, what's David doing here? Achish replied, is this not David, who was an officer of Saul, king of Israel? He has already been with me for over a year, and from the day he left Saul until now, I have found no fault in him. But the Philistine commanders were angry with Achish and said, send the man back that he may return to the place you assigned him. He must not go with us into battle, or he will turn against us during the fight. How better could he regain his master's favor than by taking the heads of our own men? Isn't this the David they sung about in their dances? Saul has slain his thousands and David his tens of thousands. Wow, that song gets around, doesn't it? So Achish called David and said to him, as surely as the Lord lives, you have been reliable, and I would be pleased to have you serve with me in the army. From the day you came to me until today, I have found no fault in you. But the rulers don't approve of you. Now turn back and go in peace. Do nothing to displease the Philistine rulers. But what have I done? Asked David. What have you found against your servant from the day I came to you until now? Why can't I go and fight against the enemies of my lord, the king? Okay, David's really playing this well. Look, he clearly has no intention of fighting Israel. He had multiple opportunities to conquer Saul before now, and he didn't act on it. But David here, he's hamming it up. And it works. Achish answered, I know that you have been as pleasing in my eyes as an angel of God. That is rich. Nevertheless, the Philistine commanders have said he must not go up with us into battle. Now, get up early, along with your master's servants who have come with you, and leave in the morning as soon as it is light. Verse 11, so David and his men got up early in the morning to go back to the land of the Philistines, and the Philistines went up to Jezreel. David was caught between a rock and a hard place. He didn't have a prayer. That man was trapped, but God got him out. Oh, can you picture the journey back to Ziklag? I bet it was all high fives and hoopla. The battle at Aphek was about 50 miles from Ziklag, a three-day journey by foot. And I'm sure David and his men celebrated God's deliverance all along the way. Can you believe it? God came through again. But when David arrives home, he finds he's left from the frying pan and the fire. Chapter 30, verse 1. David and his men reached Ziklag on the third day. Now the Amalekites had raided the Negev and Ziklag, then attacked Ziklag and burned it, and had taken captive the women and everyone else in it, both young and old. While David took his men north to Aphek, the Amalekites stormed their hometown from the south, capturing their families and setting the city ablaze. To our surprise, our narrator tells us they killed none of them, but carried them off as they went on their way. David must have seen the destruction from a distance. When David and his men reached Ziklag, they found it destroyed by fire, and their wives and sons and daughters taken captive. So David and his men wept aloud until they had no strength left to weep. David's brave men returned to find everything gone. Their families are kidnapped. Their homes are burned to the ground. Everything they own has been plundered by their enemies. In response, David's men of valor collapse into a heap and sob to the point of exhaustion. And this is personal for David. Verse 5, David's two wives have been captured, Ahinoam of Jezreel and Abigail, the widow of Nabal of Carmel. Abigail! You know, the fiery, faithful woman we met last week. Even Abigail's been taken. No one's left untouched by this tragedy. I can't fathom riding David's emotional roller coaster, mourning over the loss, angry over the injustice. But everything gets worse in verse 6. David was greatly distressed because the men were talking of stoning him. Each one was bitter in spirit because of his sons and daughters. Their grief turns to bitterness and their bitterness to rage. And that rage has found its focal point in their leader. As far as we can tell, this is the first time David's leadership is questioned. And perhaps they're right. David, their leader, was well aware of the Amalekites. David, their leader, led his men on similar raids throughout the territories of Amalek. But David, their leader, journeyed north with the Philistine army, leaving their families completely unprotected, knowing all too well the vengeful nature of their enemy to the south. David should have known better. Imagine the guilt. Imagine the shame. David blew it, and he knew it. The narrator tells us David was greatly distressed. Here we find, again, that expression that we saw in chapter 28 pertaining to Saul. Here it pertains to David. Tsar. Actually, here it's the verbal root, tsarar. David was in a tight space. He was hemmed in on all sides by his crises. He's a fugitive from his country, living precariously among his enemies, gaining new enemies while losing old friends. Imagine grief buried under anger, smothered by regret, and then washed away by despair. That's David. Yeah, I think we can say David is caught between a rock and a hard place. And I gotta wonder, do you feel like David? Maybe you're getting walloped on all sides. Your prospects for new clients have dried up. Your potential for new friends has died down. Your coworkers are playing politics, jockeying for position. You can't keep up. The pace is too fast. Stress at work, strain at home. Every day you're missing deadlines. Every day you're disappointing people, friends, family, colleagues. You didn't think you could disappoint your dog, but now you're beginning to wonder. You haven't quit because you can't quit, because it's all up to you. But you feel defeated because you are defeated. You're being crushed by the burden of failure or the threat of failure. And on top of everything, you wrecked your car, you got a bad haircut, and they're only releasing one Marvel movie this year. Does this sound familiar to anyone? Life hurls major dilemmas at you, then peppers you with comic annoyances. And the cumulative effect is overwhelming. You feel like you're being crushed. And while you're being crushed, maybe you're asking God, where are you? Well, friends, we can't always look to David as a model of morality. In fact, many of the actions David takes in this story tonight, today, make me cringe. But friends, we can follow his lead as he responds to his failure in chapter 30. Yes, David was greatly distressed. He failed everyone he loves. His friends are ready to murder him, literally. Verse 6, but David found strength in the Lord his God. See, when David was in a tight space, when Saul was in a tight space, Saul turned to forbidden practices to find support, but not David. Somehow in the midst of calamity, David centers himself in God and finds great strength. The narrator's carefully chosen vocabulary explains, David didn't muster strength and courage from within himself. No, we're not talking about willpower or self-confidence. David's strength to keep going was established in the Lord, in who God is, not who David is. David's strength wasn't found in his talents or his track record. It was found in the character of God. And friends, there lies the key. David knew God. His faith was found in his personal relationship. The personal pronoun is emphatic. It says, David found strength in the Lord, his God. See, David is modeling for us the point I'm hoping to drive home today. Don't take your failure personally. Make your faith personal. When you're in a tight space, it's our. It feels like life is squeezing you like a vice. You know what a vice is? When I was a little boy, my dad had a vice attached to the corner of the workbench in our garage. A vice is a tool that keeps a piece of material immobile while a craftsman does something to it, usually something quite violent, like sawing or drilling or nailing. The image is fitting, isn't it? Maybe life's got you in a vice. Now, I'm not saying everything that happens to you is good. My dear friends, it isn't. However, Romans 8:28 tells us God can use everything for good, even bad things. You may be miserable right now as life has got you held in place while something's being done to you. But my friend, is it possible that God is using this vice to also do something in you? Are you looking for his work in your life? Our narrator tells us David found strength in the Lord his God. He strengthened himself. You know, what's the most interesting aspect of the verse, it's lost in translation in most of our English Bibles. The tense of the verb is reflexive. That means the action done by the verb is reflected back on the actor. Literally, the verse reads, David strengthened himself in the Lord his God. See, some people sit in their misery and wait for God to zap them. But others go and search for God when they can't see him. Okay, a few weeks ago, we talked about spiritual friendship. We found David in the cave giving him hope until he was visited by an old friend. 1 Samuel 23, verse 16, Saul's son Jonathan went to David at Horesh and helped him find strength in God. How wonderful. Now, some of us left or logged off that week thanking God for our Jonathan who helps us find strength in God. But a lot of us went away praying for a Jonathan because we don't have a Jonathan. Well, now David doesn't have a Jonathan either. In fact, after Jonathan helped David find strength in God in 1 Samuel 23, Jonathan went home. David hasn't had a Jonathan for quite a little while now. And here we are, fairly or unfairly, the people around David are ready to kill him. But it is in this moment that David does what we need to learn to do. David strengthens himself in God. Now, what did David do to strengthen himself? I don't know. Our narrator doesn't tell us. But we're probably better off not knowing, because it probably wouldn't work for us anyway. See, the things that I do to strengthen myself in God may not work for you. They may actually weaken you. Now, that shouldn't surprise us. We're all wired differently. It makes sense if you think about it, and you need to think about it if you're going to find strength in God. If you want God to work in your soul, then you have to take steps to intentionally open yourself up to his work in your soul. See, I can pray for you, but I can't do your praying for you. How should you strengthen yourself in God? There are countless ways you could do so. The one thing I can promise is you haven't tried everything yet. But for now, I'll simply point you to a few things people have found helpful through history. Solitude, study, reflection, worship. You might strengthen yourself by participating in a small group once a week. You might strengthen yourself by working through a Bible study on the YouVersion app. You might strengthen yourself by serving at our Capital Cares Distribution Center. Interestingly, one of the best ways to strengthen yourself in God is to strengthen someone else in God. But whatever you do, my friends, don't take your failure personally. Take your failure personally. Make your faith personal. David strengthened himself in God, and I want to join him. Now, you may be asking, what happens to David at Ziklag once he strengthens himself? Do his men try to stone him? Does he reunite with Abigail? Does he take a pottery class? Come back next week and you'll find out. But you know, I left you hanging earlier with my personal drama, didn't I? Here's the rest of my prayer journal. How about an update? I'm giving God an update. I'm pretty good about that. How about an update? I'm almost finished rewriting my intro. It's 11:30 a.m. I'm trusting you with this sermon, Lord. I'm trusting you with this test. I'm banking on you, not my time or my talent. You see, my prayer journal is one way I strengthen myself in God. I keep working through Psalm 57. My heart, oh God, is steadfast. My heart is steadfast. I will sing and make music. I write this. David's poem continues to feature repetition. It's throughout the poem. My heart is steadfast. The verb to be steadfast means to be established, to be steadfast, to be firm, to be prepared. My heart is established even now. As I weep, apparently I was crying as I was writing this. As I weep, I sing and make music to you. This is 30 minutes after my hard drive crashed, by the way. I sing and make music to you. You've got me. Thank you for your grace. What a gift. You are so good. Thank you for strengthening me for this season. What do you want to do next, Lord? Look out, Satan. The Lord is on the move. The Most High is acting. Now, friends, remember the scenario. I lost all my writing on a day in which I was already way behind where I should have been. For a moment, I'm going to be honest, I was tempted to forego my prayer journal to devote myself simply to writing the sermon. I bet God will be okay. Someone writing the Bible's good. We're good. We're good, right? But actually, I went in the opposite direction that day. I found myself taking more impromptu breaks from my message simply to engage God in the crisis. Not every hour in the hour. That wasn't good enough for me. At 11:41, I say this to God. Just a thought. Sometimes the lessons that I learn forever, go back one. Sometimes the lesson that I learn forever is more important than my ease or comfort in the moment. Thank you for allowing my sifting. Oh, clearly God must be doing a miracle. Did you read that? I was just thanking him for letting my hard drive crash or the file get corrupted? What is wrong with me? then 12:15 p.m. I talked to God about music. What is wrong with me? I don't have time for this. Next slide. Maybe. There it is. Natalie Grant's song Hell just came on my streaming service. Huh. Lord, thank you for giving me faith. Thank you for holding me and helping me trust you. 10 minutes later, 12:25, here's an update. I have now rewritten the sermon to the point I lost everything. What did I lose? About 1 hour and 44 minutes. But what did I gain? A greater faith in my God. Another opportunity to run to my refuge. A great story for a future sermon. I really wrote that. A moment to strengthen my faith, not just for today, but for every day going forward. I found a way to be thankful in the midst of a test. I found a way to identify the application of this message, sifting, in the moment of its writing. There are many, many gifts that have come from this moment. I thank you, God. I ask, is this a moment when you showed up to rebuke, mock, insult my enemies? Are you saying to Satan, nanny, nanny, boo-boo? Really, unedited, people, this is what I wrote. Whatever the case, my heart is steadfast. I celebrate what you're doing. Then I move on to verse 8. David writes, awake, my soul. Awake, harp and lyre. I will awaken the dawn. I write, first, David commands himself, wake up. That implies he's been asleep, or at least unaware of what's going on. Just like the disciples needed to be roused from their slumber to pray against temptation, I say to my soul, wake up. 1:04 p.m., I refine my previous idea. Sometimes the lessons we learn for tomorrow are more important than the comforts we desire today. Yeah, I wonder if that's going to show up in a sermon someday. 1:30 p.m., Verse 9, I will praise you, Lord, among the nations. I will sing of you among the peoples. I praise you, my Lord, among the nations. I'm going to spread the word. I'm going to be the light you want me to be and shine the light of your abundant life to all who can see it. I sing your song to all who hear it. Lord, I'm a believer, unshakable. Thank you. 2:30 p.m., verse 10, for great is your love, reaching to the heavens. Your faithfulness reaches to the skies. Great is your chesed, your love. It's higher than the stars in the sky. And it's that love you send from heaven. Your emet, your faithfulness, is so big, it sustains me and establishes me when blank. Lord, help me experience your great love even now. Finally, I come to the end of David's psalm, verse 11. Be exalted, O God, above the heavens. Let your glory be over all the earth. I conclude. Repetition rules this psalm. And David ends his song with the refrain from verse 5. Lord, be exalted in this sermon. May your name be lifted up. May your love and faithfulness be seen and heard as I speak. May it frighten away the shame and disgust that people have been feeling about themselves or others. May your glory, your holy essence, fill the room tonight and tomorrow. Come, Holy Spirit, and show your people who you are. I love you. And I can't believe I get to do this. Now, I circle back to our principle for the day. Friends, do not take failure personally. Don't let it lock you up, freeze you in terror, or cause you to overreact. Don't take your failure personally, but make your faith personal. That's something you can do. And friends, making your faith personal keeps you from taking failure personally. It prevents failure from seeping into your identity. It keeps failure from defining you. Because as you take your faith personally and interact with a very personal God who loves you more than you could ever imagine, you come to find out, well, failure is a big deal, but we can learn from failure because we're loved. We're loved by an infinite God of the universe who cares more about you than you could ever think or imagine. May you make your faith personal, friends. Pray with me. Lord, in this moment, I pray for my friends that they would find ways to take their faith personally. I pray they find ways to strengthen themselves in you each day. I want to pray for the person who's new to faith. May they find simple, practical ways to connect to you each day. I pray for the person who's been journeying with you for decades, but they feel stuck and stalled in that journey. Lord, I pray they'd find new ways that they can find strength in you for the journey. Pray for my friends who don't know you well. Oh, even for them. May they begin a conversation with you in which you reveal to them your unceasing love, your faithfulness, your trustworthiness, so they might put their trust in you. I pray in the name of Jesus. Amen. Okay, friends, I'm going to give you a little homework. Here's your first assignment. Pray through Psalm 57. Now, I just prayed through it with you in my prayer journal. You don't need to know Hebrew and do all that. Just find a great English translation and pray through it. Ask God to speak to you through it. See what he tells you about your present circumstances, okay? Psalm 57, join David in the cave. And one more thing I want to ask you to do. It's a book. I recommended it on Easter weekend. I'm going to recommend it again, and this is not the last you'll hear of this book. It's called Practicing the Way by John Mark Comer. I'm going to say this, and I'm not going to flinch when I say it. This is one of the most important books I've read in years and years and years. It's that good. It helps us to see the way of Jesus. Very simply put, Comer tells us how to be with Jesus, in other words, strengthen ourselves in Jesus, so that can become like Jesus, so that we can do as Jesus did. But it starts with being with him. And he gets really practical about what that even means, to be with Jesus. This book means so much to me. We started to work through it as a staff. We just started this week looking at the first section of the book. And maybe that's something you want to do with a group of friends, maybe in your small group, maybe you want to make a small group. Get two or three friends together, go through this book section by section, meet once a week, twice a month, whatever you want to do, and you can take those questions that we have on those message note cards, those four questions. That's how we do it as a staff. We've been doing it for a decade. We'll just go through a book, go through a video, whatever we're working through, and we'll ask those four questions. What did you learn? What surprised you? What bothered you? What resonated with you? And it creates a great discussion as we unpack. Nobody has to prepare other than to read and answer your own questions those ways. And it provides an opportunity for you to work through something in community, because that's an important part of our growth. One of the best ways you can grow into the person that Jesus called you to be is to be with other people who are doing the same, okay? So I really want to encourage you to pick up this book. You can get it digitally. You can get it on audio. And Comer has an incredible website, Practicing the Way, where he gives more tools, and they're all free for you to find how you can learn to put spiritual practices into practices so you can be with Jesus, okay? Stand with me. All right, here's the verse for the week, friends. 1 Samuel chapter 30. Verse 6, we read it a moment ago. David strengthened himself in the Lord his God. I want you to do that this week. The image of the verse that's on the screen and the graphic I've been showing you throughout this message, both will be available for you to download from our website, so be watching for them. If you'd like to receive prayer, if you're here in the building, you can come to the front and ask someone to pray for you before you go. All of you, especially those of you who are online, please send us an email, care@capitalchurch.com, so we'd love to connect with you. Friends, here's my prayer for you. May you never take your failure personally. But instead, may you make your faith personal by finding creative and effective ways to strengthen yourself in the Lord your God. Thanks for coming to church. Grace and peace.